Congress is facing a government shutdown if they don't pass a spending plan by tomorrow. Representative Sherry Bustos says lawmakers are taking too long to come to an agreement.
I have been willing to give a little time to try to work through these details. And when there is this constant unwillingness to sit down with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to solve our nation's problems, my patience is wearing a little bit thin.
And Chicago Democrats Jan Schakowsky and Luis Gutierrez endorsed someone who's never run for office in order to beat a seven-term congressman from their own party. Here's Representative Gutierrez.
It's not easy to endorse a challenger over a colleague, but I think this is a very special and at the same time a very dangerous time that we live in America.
But first, why this year's flu outbreak is one of the worst in years. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. How are you feeling today? Hopefully pretty good. But if you thought to yourself, I'm a little achy, my throat's sore, actually maybe I have a fever. I don't want to alarm you, but it might be possible you're coming down with the flu. You wouldn't be the only one. Hopefully, though, if you've been hit, yours is a mild case. For many, this year's illness has been severe and even fatal. According to the Centers for Disease Control, this year's influenza outbreak is the most widespread it's ever seen. And the Illinois Department of Public Health says this year's flu season appears to be peaking early throughout the state, right now, rather than later this winter. I'm joined now by Dr. Brian Curtis, the director of physician practice at OSF Medical Group in Peoria, and Dr. Chris McDowell, an emergency physician at SIU School of Medicine. He also works at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Dr. Curtis, welcome back. Dr. McDowell, thanks for both of you for being with us here on the 21st.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much. For now, for all of you out there who have questions for either doctor about the flu, influenza, flu vaccine, you can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet your questions or comments to 21STShow. That's our Twitter handle. Dr. Curtis, just from looking around, whether I think everybody's noticed this in their family, certainly coworkers around our office here, around the newsroom, we've all noticed that the flu is worse this year. But I wonder what you're actually seeing. Is the actual strain of flu people are catching actually worse this year than in years past, Dr. Curtis?
It is this year, and so the predominant strain we're seeing is kind of the one we predicted to see, which is the H3N2, the influenza A, the same one they saw in Australia. And so it's a strain that hasn't been seen for a while, and so since it hasn't been seen and circulated in the population, it's a little bit different. People have been more sick with it. I think also when the flu kind of hit, which is kind of the week before Christmas, is when it really started showing. Was kind of an inopportune time with the holidays and the gatherings that people have, which gave a kind of a prime opportunity to share it. So,
right. So at least for what you're seeing and what you're seeing, Dr. Curtis, in Peoria, are you seeing more cases than you normally would see this time of year?
Yeah. So, you know, we're about 3 or 4 weeks ahead. Usually our flu season has tended to be kind of starting around mid to late January, so right about now it usually starts. So we're about a month ahead of where we're used to being. And so, you know, our prompt cares are very, very busy. Our emergency departments are busy. The hospital's full and busy, and so are our doctor's offices.
Dr. McDowell, are you seeing the same thing in Springfield?
We have, and I would agree. Usually our peak in Central Illinois and Springfield tends to be mid to late January. And clearly at the end of December, we were seeing a very big rise in the number of positive tests and then just a tremendous surge. Now, the good news is the last data I saw from the CDC for the state of Illinois seems to show it declining just around the time of the change of the new year.
And when we're looking at the data and we look at the vaccine, how much of this is an effectiveness of what we've seen? From what I've heard, this year's flu vaccine was maybe 20 to 30% effective. Dr. McDowell, is that accurate?
So it really depends how you're figuring the statistics. And there are a lot of challenges to making a flu vaccine that are different from many of the other vaccines that we're used to thinking of. So we basically try to estimate the typical types of strains of flu that we'll see in our hemisphere about 9 months early. based on the other half of the world's experience. And then we make a vaccine around those strains. And some years we match it very well. Other years they miss a little bit. One of the other challenges is that we make the flu vaccine in eggs. And in that process of manufacturing, sometimes the vaccine can change a little bit and then be less effective. And I think we have a combination of both of those challenges this year with our vaccine. That being said, there is still very good evidence to get a flu vaccine, and it's still worth getting one even for this season if you haven't done it yet.
Okay, so it's not too late for this year.
It's not too late.
I'm speaking with Dr. Chris McDowell. He's at SIU School of Medicine and Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Dr. Brian Curtis is on the line with us from Peoria, where he is at OSF Medical Group. You're welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. Dr. Curtis, does it mean that more people are coming into hospital settings for flu treatments than they would have before because of the severity of this year's influenza?
I think it is. And I think some of it is they just want to make sure that they're going to be okay. I think there's a lot of stuff in the news and in the print literature that people are seeing. They're driving them in. And this is kind of myself and Dr. McDowell both, you know, really encouraging people, you know, stay home. You know, if you're just achy and you're tolerating liquids and you're doing okay and you don't really have another medical problem, you know, the best option for you is to stay home, get plenty of rest, get plenty of sleep, make sure you're tolerating, you know, keeping liquids down, and then really kind of just stay that, because every time you come into the public, you just kind of spread the illness further. And so coming into the clinics or the prompt cares or in the emergency departments or going to school or going to work, you're just kind of propagating the illness further. And so I think it's a little bit of a mix, and I think that's why everybody right now is trying to get the word out. If you're doing okay, you more than likely will do fine. If you're in a high-risk category, you just had a baby, you're pregnant, age under 5, over 65, or you have a comorbid condition, you know, then those people probably need to talk to their physician. Otherwise, you know, just kind of listen to your mom, what she used to tell you.
And so, Dr. Curtis, I imagine that's a difficult question when you're talking about. So obviously you're saying if you're in a high-risk category, you need to call your doctor. What about when we're talking about children? When do we need to be careful about children and when we should bring children into the physician's office?
So children under 5 or tend to be, or 4 or 5 tend to be the highest risk category within this. You know, if they're not acting right, they're having high fevers that are kind of unremitting and aren't responsive to Tylenol or Motrin. They're not tolerating liquids or able to keep liquids down. They're not acting normal. And it's usually if their fever is persisting probably over, you know, 5 to 6 days, those are times that they probably should come in.
And for adults, what kind of fever is normal with the flu? Dr. McDowell?
I think it's hard to give a number. I think you will very typically see, though, a fever, and people might have that anywhere from, you know, a very low-grade fever around 100. It might be higher, 103, or even a little bit higher than that. I think it's really the constellation of symptoms. If you've got a fever, a cough, bad body aches, and chills, that really has a high likelihood just by your symptoms that you're going to have influenza. And I just want to clarify, when we say the flu or influenza, we're really talking about a respiratory virus that causes respiratory symptoms, body aches, fever, chills. A lot of us grew up thinking of the flu as a GI illness, vomiting and diarrhea, and that's a different type of viral infection than the true influenza that we're talking about today.
And Dr. McDowell, what do you do when people, you know, you guys were just talking about being careful about spreading things further by being in hospital settings, coming into urgent care centers. What do you do for people when they come in? Do you basically just tell them, go home, get rest, have plenty of fluids? How are you treating folks?
That's a great question. So if you're in a high-risk group, then you have a higher likelihood of a complication with your flu. And again, high-risk groups would be the very young, the very old, people that have diabetes, underlying lung issues like asthma or COPD, anybody who's had an organ transplant, those that are pregnant. So those individuals are susceptible to developing other things with their flu. For instance, maybe a bacterial pneumonia on top of their flu. So our job when we see them as healthcare providers is to decide who has one of these other complications and then how can we treat that. Treating the flu for most healthy people is time and supportive care, things to take care of their fever, as we already mentioned, Tylenol and Motrin. We do have antiviral medications that we can use for the flu. The challenge is that they only help lessen the symptoms and may make it go away more quickly, but they don't treat the flu the way antibiotics treat bacterial infections. So it's a little different process. So really our goal is to see who has another complication from it and who's healthy enough that could get over it on its own.
And Dr. Curtis, I think this is probably a good time to point out, I think a lot of people come into the doctor's office and they want you to do something. What do you do when people say, hey, I'd like some antibiotics, for example?
This is a thing that Dr. McDowell and I deal with on a daily basis, and it's really us just educating that antibiotics aren't indicated in a majority of the stuff that we see within these kind of seasonal illnesses, because a vast majority of them are viral-related illnesses. And our job is to educate, and then the public's job is to actually trust us in our education when we're telling them that you don't need an antibiotic, that you really don't need it. And that's set up to do two things. One is to protect you from any adverse effects from the antibiotic, either an allergy development or you can get an infectious diarrhea from it. And even more importantly is to protect you later on and further down the road by lowering antibiotic resistance within the environment, because the more antibiotics we put out there, the more resistant the bacteria become to them. And so when you actually need the antibiotic, we want to be able to give it to you and have it be effective.
Dr. McDowell, when we talk about the CDC saying the flu is the most widespread this season than it's ever been, I think we all know that the flu is contagious, but I wonder what you can tell us about how ways in which the flu spreads that we might not know about.
So the flu is really spread by droplet contact. So any kind of sneezing, coughing, where you get those droplets into the air or onto your hands or other surfaces is how we spread the flu. And one of the challenges during the winter is that we're inside because of the cold weather, and so we're in closer proximity and more likely to spread it to each other. So the things that we should do to try to prevent that are obviously the basics of just good hygiene day to day, covering our mouth, our nose when we cough and sneeze, washing our hands frequently. If we actually think we have the flu, trying to avoid contact with those who are at high risk, and maybe wearing a mask if we're going to be around other individuals, so that we can try to prevent the spread by droplets. One of the most important things you can do, really, and we've talked about it before, is getting the flu vaccine. And you want to get the flu vaccine really for two reasons. One is to make sure that you are at better protection so that you're less likely to get the flu. And two, you're then less likely to carry it or take it to somebody in your close proximity. And those who are immunocompromised or have some other illness are really at high risk. So getting the flu vaccination rate higher kind of helps protect us all as a society. And there's a lot of benefits to that.
Dr. Curtis, do you worry that people think that this year the vaccine, because it wasn't so effective, that will affect how many people will get it next year? Because they'll say, hey, I got the flu shot and it didn't help, or maybe they think it wasn't as effective this year, so that might prevent problems next year?
It's always a concern we have, though in my discussions with people, you know, we're seeing that the flu vaccine is, you know, 30% effective, and I tell people 30% is better than 0%, and so any little bit that you can do, and as Dr. McDowell said, the more population that you immunize, that 30% becomes a larger and larger piece of that population. And so it still is not a reason to shy away from it. And it's being shown very well that the people that we are seeing with the flu, if you've had the flu shot, you're doing better than the people that did not receive the flu shot. And so the people that we're seeing that are really sick from this, a majority of them still haven't received the flu shot. And so even though it's not a perfect match and there was probably a little bit of a shift in the virus and a little bit of a shift in the virus within the vaccine, it is still offering some cross protection that we're seeing. And so you still need to go get a flu shot. And as Dr. McDowell said, we're still recommending for people to go out and give a flu shot. And so at OSF, we've given more flu shots this year than we've ever given in our ever. And so every year we're increasing the number of flu shots that we're given. And so it's still an opportune time to go out and get it. And, you know, we do a really good job. People over 65 do a great job getting the flu vaccine. Children under 18, go get it. They do a good job because their parents bring them in to get that. It's everybody in between that is really kind of the low mark in regards to the percent of the population that we vaccinate. And so really you need to go out and get it.
I got my flu shot. I haven't gotten sick yet. I was at my doctor's office last week and she was sick. I wonder, both of you, Dr. McDowell, have you been struck by the flu this year? How do you keep yourself from getting germs?
Well, I make sure, number one, that I wash my hands all the time at work. We make good use of masks as well. And we try to be really careful with just using good droplet contact isolation to try to keep from spreading it in the healthcare centers themselves. And I think basically it's just trying to take good care of yourself then too, trying to make sure that you have enough rest and that you're well hydrated. And then some of it is luck.
Right. Dr. Curtis, hopefully you've been healthy so far this year.
Well, my kids shared the Christmas with me, so no, I didn't escape it. So, but I did practice it, so I did stay home until I felt better.
So it's a good reminder for everyone, stay home as long as you can. I imagine, gentlemen, this cold weather probably is not a great thing also for folks and for their lungs, especially if they're not feeling so great. But both of you, thank you so much for being with me. Dr. Brian Curtis directs the physician practice at OSF Medical Group in Peoria. Dr. Chris McDowell teaches at SIU School of Medicine. He also practices at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking to many of our Illinois delegation in Congress this week. Yesterday, we spoke with suburban Chicago Representative Bill Foster. There's lots of issues looming in Washington, not the least of which is potential government shutdown on Friday. Yesterday afternoon, we had a chance to catch up with Representative Sherry Bustos. She's a Democrat representing Illinois' 17th district, which includes parts of Peoria, Rockford, and the Quad Cities. Congresswoman, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
First of all, your Republican colleagues have put together a plan they said would avert a government shutdown on Friday. What are you thinking about what they've put together so far?
Well, they're adding a few good components that are mixed in with a lot of nothing also. You know, we've got a lot going on right now in our country, including about 700,000 kids who have come to our country maybe when they were babies or 1 or 2 years old, who know no other home other than America. And it is a self-inflicted wound that Donald Trump said set this deadline for Congress dealing with the deferred action of childhood arrivals, also known as DACA. And now this is not included in this continuing resolution in order to keep the government open. And now I have voted to keep the lights on out in Washington, D.C., because I thought buying a little more time would lead to some good outcomes, not only for the kids, but for health care, for making sure that, you know, places like the Rock Island Arsenal can remain viable and not have to go from, you know, a two-week budget to a two-week budget to the next two-week budget. So I've been willing to offer a little bit of time to my friends across the aisle. And now this is vote number four, where they're asking for yet a little more time to try to solve these problems. But Nyla, in between all of that, Speaker Ryan canceled votes for an entire week. He has not been open to inviting Democrats in to actually sit down and negotiate some of what we need to get solved. And, you know, I mean, at some point you have to say enough is enough.
And so for, I think it sounds like, Representative, you're at that point. You will not be voting for any federal, you won't be voting for any bills that would avert a shutdown that don't include specific action on DACA?
Well, I don't want to say that right now. I have a, you know, just like I hope every human being who needs to be voting on this has a spot in their heart to say, we wouldn't want this to ever happen to our own children. Why would we want it to happen to somebody else's kids? And again, I have been willing to give a little time to try to work through these details. And when there is this constant unwillingness to sit down with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to solve our nation's problems, my patience is wearing a little bit thin. And if you think about, you know, I'm a Democrat. I don't like to badmouth people just because they're Republicans, but we often hear the line from members of Congress who are come from the Republican Party saying that, you know, government needs to be run more like a business. Well, I can tell you can't run a business on short-term budgets from week to week. So if there's anything that they're doing is not running government like a business.
So does your sense then that this will come down to a sort of forcing that the issue will be forced then? Do you believe DACA by a government shutdown?
You know what? Let's wait and see. I don't know what else they're going to end up throwing in there in order to win votes on making sure that the government can stay open and that kids are taken care of. And it's not just the kids who have come to our country, you know, under the rules of DACA, but it's also the childhood health insurance program. It's also community health centers. I mean, it's also how we're going to pay for health insurance for people. And so I think there are a lot of components that we need to talk through. We need to come to a common understanding, and we'll see where it ends up. I don't want to jinx anything. As I sit here right now, there's too much that's missing from this proposal to keep the government open. I also, you know, don't want to play any role in, you know, turning the lights off in Washington. But the bottom line is that there's a Republican in the White House. It's a Republican-controlled House and Senate, and it is within their power to allow us to vote on something that addresses our nation's needs and also make sure that the government can stay functional.
Representative, to that point of Republican control of both houses of Congress and the executive branch, last week you released a report on what you call heartland voters in the Democratic Party. You actually wrote in the report that essentially the Democratic Party is facing an existential crisis when it comes to rural voters. And of course, we saw how many rural voters did not vote for Hillary Clinton. And in fact, in your district, President Trump won most of the vote, which likely means that people voted for both you. There were many people who voted for both you, a Democrat, and him, a Republican. I wanted to ask you, in a nutshell, your report talked about how many voters seem to think that national Democrats are just fixated on issues that don't matter to them, or they're on social issues that they don't agree with. What needs to change?
Well, and that's fairly broad to say that Democrats aren't focusing on issues that matter to voters in the Midwest. If we drill down a little bit, voters from regions like mine in central and western and northern Illinois, as downstate Illinoisans, you know, what I hear more than anything when I'm just going to, you know, we do these things called Supermarket Saturdays, and I hear from people that they want us to get something done. They want us to be able to work together, and they want us to stay focused on improving their lives through improving the economy, job opportunities. There are so many stories of people who have lost their jobs to places like China and Mexico, and, you know, maybe a dozen or so years later, they're still not making what they did when they had those good jobs. I have heard story after story of people who are working now two jobs and three jobs to pay their bills. I'm talking to people on a regular basis who haven't been able to buy a car any newer than 10 years old for years, so that they, you know, they limp along how they can even get to their jobs. And there are just so many stories like that. And I think what they want from, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you're a public servant and you are representing them in Congress or the state legislature or city council, is they want us to fight for them and just to help their families have better jobs. And when more national Democrats segment or focus on issues that don't make their lives better, they it just feels out of touch to them. And so the report that we worked on really come up with some recommendations that are, I don't think, that hard to follow. It's really showing up and listening to people, working hard, fighting for people, and helping bring people together through a common theme of economic development and economic opportunity, rather than through segmenting in, you know, through issues that divide people. And there are many of those as well, but people want us to focus on jobs and the economy more than anything else.
Well, you also talked about better communication tools for the Democratic Party in your report. And I wonder, as a former journalist, do you worry about trust that has been lost, first of all, in major news outlets?
Well, I think we have President Trump to thank for a lot of that. You know, the fact, I don't know what the status is. Today was supposed to be the day where he was having fake news awards. You know, look, I went to graduate school to learn how to be a journalist. You know, that's what my education is in. You know, I was an investigative reporter. I covered City Hall. I covered business. I had pretty much every beat that you could have at a newspaper, and I know that the journalists that work at places like the New York Times, or the Wall Street Journal, they are not producing fake news. Now, it doesn't mean that they don't make mistakes. I mean, I don't know any journalist who hasn't made a mistake in a story, but what real journalists do, if they make a mistake, they write a correction, but they keep digging and they keep reporting. And we would not want to have our country void of journalism. I mean, it's critical to making sure that people, no matter where you live in our country, can understand what's going on in government and with their elected leaders. And, you know, Donald Trump has done a lot of harm by labeling legitimate news fake news. And I'll speak out against that any day of the week, because it's so important for a functional democracy.
Representative, on Friday we are going to be talking about the second annual Women's March. There's many taking place, not just across the country, but in Illinois this coming weekend. And last year we talked to you about the women that you helped mobilize to run for office. And I wanted to ask about how you sort of saw that play out last year and this year. Do you think you still have momentum coming as you look forward to this year and to the midterm elections?
Oh, I think if you look at races, not just in Illinois, but all over the country, and the level of enthusiasm and the number of women running and younger people running and people from communities of color, all areas where we've been underrepresented for so long in elected office, it is, I absolutely think that the momentum is still there. You know, I started this Build the Bench program, I don't know, a couple years ago now, to basically offer all-day boot camps for any Democrat who is interested in running for office and understanding the fundamentals of how you win. And so we have done about 7 of these all over the state of Illinois. We've at this point had about 160 people go through those. And one thing worth noting is in the last municipal elections, we had 12 of our graduates from one of our classes on the ballot, and 8 of the 12 won, and a ninth lost by just one vote. In fact, I was with her on Martin Luther King Day, and we talked, and she is going to run again, and I think she'll be successful next time around.
One last quick question for you. Just to that end, Marie Newman is a person who has never run for any office, but she's running against one of your colleagues in Chicago, Dan Lipinski. He's been in office for 7 terms. She just got the endorsement from Jan Schakowsky and Luis Gutierrez, which is a little bit unusual for an incumbent. Are you going to be making an endorsement in that race?
No, I'm not. It's, you know, I am a colleague of Dan's in Congress here, and So that's not a race I'm entering, and you know the voters of that congressional district will make the decision, and we'll know on the end of the day on March 20th how that turns out.
Representative Sherry Bustos, of course, a Democrat for Illinois' 17th district. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Nyla.
And we spoke with Representative Bustos yesterday afternoon. The House can vote on that spending bill as soon as early as today, maybe perhaps this afternoon or this evening. We are going to be speaking with Republican Congressman John Shimkus tomorrow. As we just mentioned with Representative Bustos, could a newcomer with no prior political experience take down a seven-term congressman? That's the question at Illinois' 3rd Congressional District in Chicago's West Suburbs, where Dan Lipinski has held office. He took that seat from his father, by the way, Bill Lipinski, who represented the district for a dozen years before he did. Now, Marie Newman has gotten endorsements, as I mentioned. Everyone from Gloria Steinem to Jan Schakowsky to Luis Gutierrez yesterday in a rather unusual news conference on Capitol Hill that was streamed on Facebook Live. Representative Schakowsky and Gutierrez endorsed Newman over their fellow House member. Here's Congressman Gutierrez.
It's not easy to endorse a challenger over a colleague, but I think this is a very special and at the same time a very dangerous time that we live in America.
Chicago Magazine's Carol Felsenthal has been reporting on this race. She's on the line now from Chicago. Hi, Carol. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Carol, what do we know about Marie Newman?
Well, we know that she has never run for anything, not so much as student council president or library board member in LaGrange, where she currently lives. She's got focus. She's got energy. She seems to be at the right place at the right time. She's got the Me Too movement at her back. And she also has an endorsement, an early endorsement from Kirsten Gillibrand, which is an interesting occurrence, given that she seems to be on everybody's list to run for president. So she's got a lot of things going for her. She also, something that did not make the cut in my article, there's a growing Muslim community in the 3rd Congressional District, which is the southwest side of the city and it's going into the suburbs. And that community could be a help to her, and about a third of the district is Hispanic. So if my feeling about Marie Newman, and I'm not a person who gives predictions, but if she doesn't make it this time, I think she'd have a pretty good shot if she ran again in 2 years.
Now, why is it such a big deal that she's gotten these endorsements, Carol, especially, as you mentioned, from these members of Congress?
Gutierrez, we have to remember, my guess about Gutierrez is somebody who follows him closely. If he weren't giving up his seat, and I believe Gutierrez is looking at running for president, he's certainly an ambitious and energetic man, I don't think he would have issued an endorsement. Jan Schakowsky, I think it would be difficult for her not to endorse Marie Newman because they are one and one on the issues, whereas Representative Lipinski is probably, if not the, then one of a handful of the most conservative members of Congress. He is staunchly anti-abortion. He is now supporting the Dreamers, but he did not support them a few years ago. He is listening to constituents, and he's listening to the people who were at a couple of his town hall meetings that got pretty rowdy, and he's making some changes in his stances. But he was also one of three Democrats still in Congress to vote against the Affordable Care Act.
Wow. Yeah, Carol, we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Carol Felsenthal about this race in Chicago's western suburbs, Western Springs, the 3rd Congressional District. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Carol Felsenthal. She's a longtime political journalist, a columnist for Chicago Magazine. Her most recent piece is about Illinois' 3rd Congressional District. That's in Chicago's western suburbs, where Dan Lipinski has held office for 7 terms. Those of you who know Illinois' political history will remember that he won that seat from his father, Bill Lipinski, who had represented the district for about a dozen years before that. All told, Carol, what is it, about 26 years Lipinski's have held office in that district?
Right. And I was thinking during the break that Bill Lipinski represents many of his constituents. It is a white working class conservative area. It includes the bungalow belt of Midway Airport. It includes Berwyn, Cicero, Oak Lawn. So I think that Lipinski is not all that out of step with his constituents. I think he will be in the future more than he is now, but I write in the piece that he's presenting himself as a Dan 2.0 and changing some of his views, but his views against same-sex marriage and against abortion are embedded in his Catholicism, and those views are unlikely to change. But Dan Lipinski has a name that we hear all the time in his corner, and that's Mike Madigan. Mike Madigan was a big supporter of his father. Mike Madigan is a big supporter of the son, and he will go all out, get his precinct workers out. Also, Lipinski has the unions behind him, and people forget how he got there. Dan Lipinski, who is a shy, retiring man, he's one of the most unlikely politicians, not a glad-hander. He was a professor of political science, although he's trained as an engineer. He has a PhD in political science. They are very scholarly, academic kind of man. He was teaching political science at the University of Tennessee when his father engineered this handoff and manipulated the situation to just hand the seat to his son. But it hasn't been a problem for Dan Lipinski. He's a hard worker back in the district every weekend, a serious man. And, you know, I think I said I don't give predictions, but I would be kind of surprised if he were to lose.
Now, you were also tweeting yesterday, Carol, that this race wouldn't have been possible. Marie Newman's campaign and the endorsements she received wouldn't have been possible without the Me Too movement. I wonder what you meant by that, as well as if these endorsements you think sort of represent more of a shift within the Democratic Party moving more towards the left.
Well, one thing about the Me Too movement, and anybody who follows politics will have seen that there seems to be, I don't know if you'll agree with me, but you can kind of see a budding backlash against Me Too. And we're talking about a race. We're now in January. The race is 2 months away, March 20th. So Me Too may have flattened out a little bit by then. Some of the, as you would expect, some of the excesses are coming to the fore. But I do think one of the people who I interviewed for the article said something that I thought was very smart, that when women, even women who don't follow this race closely and couldn't tell you too much about the candidates, or when they see the name Marie on the ballot and they see the name Daniel on the ballot, they may go for the woman. So I think that really is a factor. Now, Gloria Steinem, an icon, a name that a lot of people know, and Kirsten Gillibrand, less known but important. If they come to the district to campaign for her, that'll be one thing. But without that, they may not make as much of a difference. Maybe they'll do robocalls. You know, who knows what'll happen in the next couple of months. And then a couple of things that are important that are interesting about this race is that Bernie Sanders won the primary against Hillary Clinton in the 3rd district, but Hillary Clinton won against Donald Trump by 15.5 points.
in this district. So it'll be interesting.
In the general election, yes.
So, Carol, let's just step away from this race in a moment, and let me just ask you one last question then about female voters this year, especially as we think about the Women's March that's coming up this weekend. And the repercussions of Me Too. Do you think that there will be continue to be the level of activism and engagement that we've seen over the past year with not necessarily this race? As you said, it sounds like this race is a bit of a long shot for Marie Newman, given the amount of money and support of House Speaker Mike Madigan and longtime, you know, he's an incumbent. You know, there's always...
And the unions. The AFL-CIO would just right. not endorse him.
That said, a turnout is always what makes a difference with these races. What do you think? I'm just wondering what you're thinking and seeing generally among female voters in Illinois this year.
I think that women are energized. I think that the task that is ahead of Marie Newman is that she has to get these women to come out and vote, because the Lipinski voters will come out and vote, and there are a lot of them, and they see Dan Lipinski as being somebody who stands up for them. But as I say, Dan Lipinski is making some changes in his approach, because he's had very little opposition in the his many terms in Congress, and now he has somebody who is catching the national spotlight. The political websites and publications are all putting this race in one of the races to watch, and I think that could make a difference if she can energize women to get out and vote.
Of course, the Women's March is taking place. There's a couple marches that are taking place across Illinois this Saturday, but we'll be talking about that on the program tomorrow. By the way, if you're going, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. Tell us if you're going to the Women's Marches this weekend, why you're going. Again, that number is 217-300-2121. Carol Felsenthal, longtime political columnist with Chicago Magazine. Thanks for being with us, Carol.
Sure, anytime. Thank you.
Those of you who have visited the Field Museum in downtown Chicago have undoubtedly met Sue, the 40-foot-long T-Rex, who used to greet you at the main entrance, or I think as of the last couple of weeks, is still there before she moves. If you hit it off with Sue, you can actually take her home, well, sort of. The N.W. Harris Learning Collection at the Field Museum actually allows members to take home different artifacts from the museum, including a replica full-sized T-Rex skull like Sue's. You'd have to have a big car to fit her head in it. The collection's online catalog has more than 450 items, ranging from 300-million-year-old fossils to ancient Egyptian board games to a box of preserved flies. We're joined now by WBEZ Chicago reporter Monica Ng, who was recently at the Field Museum checking out the rentals. Monica, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla.
So, Monica, you wrote about the room where all of these artifacts are stored. What was it like in this space where finding out that, and also just finding out that you could rent things from the Field Museum? Who knew that?
It was a big shock. You know, I've been in Chicago my whole life, and I had no idea. But I was researching a question about whether or not the Art Institute actually lent out its paintings back in the day, and I stumbled upon this. And FYI, the Art Institute did lend out its paintings for many, many years, but that's a whole other story. But when I went to the lower level of the Field Museum and saw this room that just goes back for rows and rows and shelves of boxes, I was amazed. I was like a kid in a candy shop. So many cool things you can take home.
And who can take them home? Anyone?
Well, it used to be, when this started more than 100 years ago, it was just for Chicago school teachers. This, you know, was something where they could bring in a replica of a volcano or fossils or animals or the way plastic is made or the way coal mines work. They could bring these dioramas into their classroom. But then, I don't know, sometime in the last 50 years, no one at the museum quite knows, they just opened it up to the public quietly. And suddenly, you know, any Joe, Tom, Dick, and Harry could go in there and walk out with this stuff and borrow it for a couple weeks.
How much does it cost?
Well, you can get these packages. You can get a package to rent out one thing for $10 or 40 things for $100, which, in case you don't know math, breaks down to $2.50 to rent some of these really interesting exhibits, dioramas, specimens, and bring them home for a couple weeks.
And then what happens if you don't bring them back? Do they have your credit card on file, or I wonder?
Well, to become a member of this N.W. Harris Learning Collection, you do pay $10 for your membership. And they do have information on you, because the $10 also pays for, in case, you know, maybe you chip something or break it. They said, you know, minimal fees for stuff that's damaged. But they said that they've had a really good history of people returning them and keeping them safe. But again, they said they're happy to fix, you know, whatever accidentally gets broken. But people tend to return this stuff.
Monica, people might not remember this or recall this, but the Field Museum has a vast store of archives. Most of it, I'm not sure, you can probably know what percentage of the Field Museum is actually on display. Is that part of what's behind here, of what's being lent out?
It is not. And, you know, I have been interviewing a whole bunch of museum folks, and they say that you usually see less than 1% of what the museums actually have. And the same is true for the Field Museum. But here, this is a separate collection from their permanent collection. This originally got assembled when N.W. Harris, the old Harris Bank, for those who remember that bank, he had a bunch of stuff that he wanted to donate to the museum, anthropological stuff, scientific stuff. And then over the years, they had other things at the museum whose provenance they couldn't quite pinpoint. And so they said, hey, let's put it in the N.W. Harris collection. And it's just gotten bigger and bigger. There are about 450 dioramas alone. But then when you add everything else in, it's about more than 1,500 items.
And what kind of things are there? We mentioned a couple things. There's a replica of a T-Rex skull like Sue's, which must be huge.
That one's the only one that's outside of the $10 renting. I think it's actually $200 if you want to bring that to your next party. And you do need a pickup truck to take it home. They also have, you know, 300-million-year-old fossils. They have a lot of things where you can learn, let's say, wild Chicago. It's got a raccoon pelt and deer antlers and a real rat and a squirrel in a tube. And kids love looking at that. And different insects that are native to the Chicago area. A lot of the stuff you can touch. They have a whole African instruments box where you can play a thumb piano or a balafone or a shaker. They have these great old industrial dioramas that tell you all the byproducts of corn. They tell you how linoleum is made. My favorite is beef and its byproducts, which obviously came from the time when Chicago was a big meatpacking area, and we had all of these offshoot industries for the hide and the hoofs and the blood and the intestines of animals. They have this whole thing about bears, where they have a bear pelt, a bear claw, and artificial bear feces that you can touch, and they're really squishy. They have an enormous wild turkey that a lot of people like to reserve for Thanksgiving, so get your reservation in now.
I imagine a stuffed wild turkey, right? Is it kind of
Yeah. Not alive. But it's enormous, and it's just, you know, you're going to need a big car to take that home. I mean, anthropological stuff, biological stuff, birds, so many birds that you can take home. If you're a birder and you want to look up close at a taxidermied version of the bird you'd always wanted to see, it's likely there. The gray fox is one of the most popular. They say everybody wants to take the gray fox home and look at him because he's so cute. He's just sitting there looking at you.
Monica, did you take anything home?
I haven't yet. I was thinking for a certain 12-year-old's birthday, I would get him a 40-item card so that he could just take these home. And then, you know, it really encourage kids to learn about these things or just show it off at a dinner party. The beef and the byproducts box could be great.
Yeah, that would be great to pull out the intestines during dinner. I think that would make it very popular.
You know, a tea party, this whole thing about how tea is made, it's great.
WBEZ's Monica Ng. They'll have a video up, I believe, on their website. We'll tweet that out when that's up, about all of the things that you can rent from the Field Museum. There's a story as well. We'll tweet that link out if you follow us at 21ST Show. WBEZ's Curiosity reporter, Monica Ng. Monica, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. As I mentioned, tomorrow we're going to be talking about the women's marches this weekend. If you're going, give us a call. Let us know why you're going. Our phone number, our hotline, is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. You can also email your story to us, talk@21stshow.org. You can also send us a message on Facebook. Search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment what we're working on or post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Robin Lynn and Alan Montesilio. Libby Foster is our production assistant. Grace Stetson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. As I mentioned, you can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for all the information about how to get in touch with us, how to follow us on social media. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.